Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Holly, and I'm from Ann Arbor. And not only am I from Ann Arbor, I'm an alcoholic. All weekend, we have been talking about, remember I said the word, about the grace of God. For one moment, please, those of you that wish to, let's talk to him. Let's say the surrender, pray the surrender prayer. God, grant me serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Thank you. How would you like for someone to constantly going around telling someone else how much they loved you? Wouldn't you want them to tell you that instead of telling everybody else? First, I want to thank you for inviting me to be here. It's really been a pleasure. And anyone that lives in this beautiful place and you don't appreciate it, I hope the sheriff runs out of town. Because it is beautiful. We've spoken about how wonderful, what a beautiful job the chairman have done, and they really have. I have never seen a more laid-back chairman than J.B. did. And his two henchmen are marvelous. Now I'm talking about Neo and Gonzalez. All you have to do is they jump and they ask how high. You know. They both are sweet. I have adopted them as my sons. Everywhere I go, I adopt somebody as my son. And I think that they're just lovely. All of you are just beautiful people. You know one thing? You really are. You are very, all you got to do is get this side of the Rockies and you will find, and I'm not lying because you see, after all, I didn't lie to you. I didn't ask you could I come here. You invited me. So I'm going to lie to you. But all you got to do is just get west of the Rockies and you will find the sweetest, lovingest, kickingest, arrogantest, eatingest people you've ever seen in your life. You know, I mean it. You really are. You're beautiful people. And I love every one of you, and I thank you again and again for letting me be, with God's help, a part of this wonderful organization. And you know another thing? I'd like to this, you know, together we can make it. Because, you know, it had just been a few days prior to being invited here that I used those words. And I'll tell you in what context I used those words. Little young lady, you know how pride does get in the way of our wanting to be sober. Our pride gets in the way of admitting that you're an alcoholic. And this young lady was telling me, she was saying, oh, just think, just look at me, at what a condition I'm in. My people came and established or whatever you do to a country. They came over here in a covered wagon and now just look at me now. The thing, do you realize my ancestors, oh, she went on and on about her ancestors coming over in a covered wagon. And look at me now, I said, darling, mine came over in chains, but look at me now. I don't know. You may not like me before I leave, but that's okay. I said to my group, I had to be gone last weekend and this weekend, and I said to my group, I said, well, girls, I belong to a women's group, it's my home group. I said, girls, I'm going to be gone away for a couple of weekends, but I'd like to know what topic that you're going to talk on before I leave, you know. I said, never said that. One of them popped up and said, gratitude. I said, you see, I am well-loved. I guess that's the reason why I love working and being around the new people so much, for the simple reason is, now, you see, I want to know, now, I'm not a dictator, nor the type of person that likes to dominate people. I like to, you know, instruct people. There's a difference between dominating a person and instructing a person. Now, you ask any hour nine if that isn't true. There's a difference there, you know. It certainly is, you know. I am not here this morning to give you my autobiography. I don't feel that that's necessary. The mere fact that I was born, that's obvious. I'm here, you know. When I was born is none of your business. But I will tell you this. I'm in the last half of the ninth inning, but I'm still up at bat. You know. I've been around a day or two. Through the grace of God and this fellowship, you know. I must have a few more critters around here, you know. To begin to tell you what brought me here. Well, you know, someone asked me, how did you ever get there? How did you ever know? What started the whole thing? I wish I could get there. I said, well, it's simple. Just drink wine. That's what I did. Now, I don't want you to think that I am a wino. I was not a wino. Women are not winos. I was a winette. I had my share of it, you know. I started drinking this stuff quite early. Man, wine wasn't my first drink. You know, the big book tells us our stories reveal in a general way what we used to be like and what happened and what we're like now. Well, my dear, I got to catch a plane. I can't go into all what I used to be like. But the mere fact is, what I like to tell you is what happened. Just briefly, what I used to be like. And anybody in here that has ever drank to any degrees, you know that feeling of when you wake up in the, you can't call it morning, I say when you wake up, and it's six, and you don't know what six it is, you know. The clock just says six. And you got to go to the bathroom, and somebody's going to ask you, are you just now getting up, or are you coming in? And so you don't go to the bathroom. You don't want to answer that. You want a drink of water, and you're scared they're going to ask you the same question, so you don't. You just lay there and suffer at both ends, so you don't do that. You don't bother about that. And, of course, I know most of you are a lot younger than I, and I don't know whether you ever, shall we say, visited pawn shops or not, and I was one of those that did that, too. I had a watch that stayed in the pawn shop so much it wouldn't run on a Jewish holiday, you know. So, I know about all those things, and so, you know, we won't go into all that. I did get married. Marriage is like vaccinations. On me, they don't take. But I always wanted something that was mine. I wanted some children, you know. Well, I know what I know now, and I had the children and forgot the rest of it. I know I'll take it back. But nevertheless, what brought me here? What happened? After a number of years, more than I care to talk about with my wine and whatnot. See, I always drank wine because I felt that was not my first drink. My first drink, I got that when I was about 14 years old at home. My grandfather had, he was not an alcoholic, but he had some alcohol there, whiskey in the bottle, and with rock candy and stuff, and I'd see him come in and take a sip out of it for his arthritis, and I tried that, and it worked, you know, arthritis or not. But you see, there was one thing that I liked about wine. Wine, I always felt, if you drank wine, it was sophisticated to drink wine. You know, it gives you an air of sophistication if one drank wine. Now, you ever imagine anybody drinking Mad Dog being sophisticated? My favorite beverage, you know. But after going through all of this, and as I said, I got married there, and I had two kids, and I'm not going to go into all that. The marriage didn't last too long. He was a gambler, and he was throwing it away fast, and I could drink it up, so he didn't get going. I couldn't be bothered with that. And naturally, one has to have a job, and I had one. I worked in a bar. I believed in on-the-job training. That's very nice. But finally, all of those good things, you know, have to come to an end. And you see, I have to tell you one thing to make my point, and that is this. When I came to this fellowship, I thought I was a helpless, hopeless drunk. That's exactly what I thought. And I'll tell you why I thought this way. I lived in this very small community, and we had this very small church. I'll never tell you that I was a practicing Catholic. I was a practicing alcoholic that went to Catholic church. And we were going to have a festival to celebrate our little schoolhouse. And we had the four first black nuns in the state of Michigan. And of course, like all good alcoholics, I went to help out. And have you ever said, I will not drink, I'm not going to drink nothing right now, you know, but you finally, until you learn this, find out about this fellowship, you think of this. Well, you hear something, it's something like, I got to go where the wild goose goes, or words to that effect. Well, when I got there to at this grand celebration, it was a celebration, it was really something, you know. And almost as great as the one you, because when you people pulled off this one, it is a humdinger you got here today. I mean, go all out. I thought you were going to fire a cannon the other night, eh? Without getting back to this celebration I was talking about, when I got there, I went right straight to, I asked Mother Superior right off the reel. I said, Mother, is there anything I can help you do? And she said, no, darling, go and enjoy yourself. Never tell a practicing alcoholic to go and enjoy yourself. But I went to the caretaker's house, and there he had a bottle of wine, but it wasn't my kind of wine. It was cooking wine, you know. And he was, all the adults, you know, I'm doing this celebration, he was giving them all a little drink out of one of these little insult glasses about like that, you know. And I had any gratitude. And so first thing you know, they ran out. And so then I thought, you know, I would go and replenish the stock, and I got them their kind and my kind. Well, you know what happened. So by now I think, no, maybe I'd better go over here and help Mother Superior, ask Mother Superior if anything I can do. So on the way out, one of our good parishioners was making barbecue. And I thought, well, maybe I'd better eat something that'll straighten me out a little bit, you know. It did. I took the barbecue rib, and he wasn't waiting on me fast enough, and I stuck it down in the sauce about up to here. And another one of our parishioners had the unmitigated nerve to say, Holly Martin, you can't do that. She shouldn't have said that to me. Now, they tell me, and I presume that I did, that I took the rib and I hit her, they said. And I waved it around the time. Now, I tried to justify this, you know. I said, well, if Samson took the jawbone of an ass and killed out a whole, wiped out a whole army, how come I can't hit her with one rib of a pig, you know? Well, she got to be so snobbish. Well, anyway, I went home. Now, here is where the beginning of my knowing that I am a helpless, hopeless drunk. On my living room wall, I had a large picture of our divine Lord. You see, I was so very ashamed of what I had done. If I could have fell down in a manhole, you see, when I got to, throwing that rib around, you know, none of them know this, where these bed bed spots look like you've been killing bed bugs on. When I got home, I looked at that picture on the wall, and I said, dear God, if ever again in my life I take a drink, strike me dead. I meant that. I meant it. I was so ashamed of what I had done in front of all of these. I wasn't ashamed of hitting her, but I was ashamed of hitting her in front of these people, you know. See, most of the time, we're not ashamed of what we do. We're just ashamed we get caught doing what we do. We're not ashamed of what we do. So anyway, I said, well, I know what I'll do. I meant this when I said, dear God, please, never again. So the next day, the good father sent for me, bless his heart. And here come two nuns down the street, and they drug me up the street. Everybody come out in the street, out of the pool room, grocery store. What's Martin done now, you know? They take me up here before the good father, and he was placed out of pledges that day. And he said, Holly, I want you to promise me one thing, that you will never again take a drink until you see me take a woman into my house. To this, I readily agreed. You know, anything to get him off my back. But on the way home, I got to thinking, I can't hang around here and watch this man and see what he's going to do. Maybe I ought to get a six-pack and think that over. You know. So when I got home, I looked at the picture and I said, Lord, I didn't mean beer, you know? And then wasn't long before I was drinking whiskey, and I said, God, I didn't mean whiskey. Finally, I'm back on wine, and I said, God, just forget it. Yeah. So that was the beginning of my knowing that I was a helpless, hopeless alcoholic. You know? I knew that. Another thing had happened that brought this to me. See, I loved those children of mine very dearly. I won't go into all that. Now I look at that love, it was a great deep possessiveness. They're mine. See, I was an orphan and something to have something of mine. One morning I couldn't get up off of the couch. And my son at that time, see, my children always used to meet me end up doing something or other. And to see mother laying on the couch and can't get up, you know, they'd wonder what the world's wrong with mother. And I said, son, go across the street, and I called this lady's name, and I said, go and ask her, and I hate beer. I said, go over there and ask her if she got anything to drink. And he came back with two of the most despicable cans of beer that you can give anybody. Goebbels and Pfeiffer's, horrible stuff. But I drank them down immediately, and my two children stood there looking at me. And I saw something in my children's eyes. In other words, it was a hurt. You see, before any time that had ever been ill with the flu or bad cold, they waited on me hand and foot. And now here's mother laying here, and we don't know what to do for her. Man, I'm going to tell you something. That tore me up. Yeah. Yeah. I looked at that hurt in those eyes. God. But still, powers over alcohol. Finally, one Saturday night, I happened to be in my living room. No, kitchen. Started in the kitchen. The miracle started in the kitchen. Story came on over the radio. It was called The Glass Crutch, and it was about a woman that had a drinking problem. Now, I did not turn that radio on to that station, because when you're in my condition, you just buy a radio and you plug it in, the thing plays, so it gives out, you know. And you hear voices all the time in the house, so what difference does it make? Where's the radio, and you can't turn them off. But it was about a woman that had a drinking problem. And to this day, my friends, it doesn't even mean the ingredients. It simply said, if you need our help, we'll be the first number in the book. Boy, I thought, I don't need your help. Yeah. That was 6 or 7 years prior to my coming into the fellowship that I heard that story. Yeah. 6 or 7 years. You see, the book of books tells us the story of the sower. The sower that went out to sow the seed. Yeah. And some of the seed fell by the wayside, and the birds got him. You know, that's the person that comes in and going to rewrite the big book. The birds are going to get him. You know what I mean? And then the seed, some of it fell on stony ground. And for a while, it flourished. It grew up. But because it had no depth, it soon withered away. That's the person that comes in and says, I don't need the spiritual. I don't want none of that spiritual. I don't buy that. You can't buy the grace of God. If you did, you'd all be on the welfare. You can't buy it. Then again, the sower goes out to sow seed, and this time it falls among the thorns and the thistles. And because it is such a delicate little thing, the thorns and thistles crowd it out. That's the person that thinks. He got a whole lot of his old ideas. The thorns and thistles are going to get you. And then again, the sower goes out to sow seed, and this time it falls on fertile ground. You see, for a long time, the seed was on fertile ground. My ground was fertile. It was steeped in manure, kids. It was fertile. But I didn't know what to do about it. Finally, that day came, but I didn't understand what the words of the glass crutch meant. Finally, the day came when I was sitting in my living room. Now, those words had come to my mind when I'd be walking down the street, the glass crutch, the glass crutch. The clock seemed to say at times, the glass crutch, the glass crutch. Finally, this day, I'm sitting in my living room trying to read the newspaper, and it seemed as if every word on there said the glass crutch. And I said, my Lord, what does this mean? And I looked down at my hand, and there I was holding the glass crutch, reading the newspaper upside down, or however you read one when you're drunk. Now, it would sound dramatic to say I dropped the paper and I ran to the phone and called the number, but you know, after sitting there for a while, I did look in the book. I was hoping it to be lying, that it wasn't in there, but it was there. First number in the book, and I called, and the lady said, I told her, I got a friend out here. I think she's losing her mind. I said, would you send somebody out to talk to her? And the lady said, would you like to have somebody talk to you? And I said, oh, no. Sooner or later, I'm right back there again, and I called, and she said, we'll have someone call you. And she did. And this woman called me, and she said one of the stupidest things you could ever say to a person. She said, now, if you've got anything out there to drink, get rid of it. I did. I drank it up. Now, I have reached the stage of zombieism. That is, if you don't drink, you don't get sober. If you do drink, you don't get drunk. You ever been in the stage of zombieism? I mean, plain old zombieism. You know, somebody holds your hand up and stays there, you know? But, you know, alcohol is everything the big book says it is, cunning, baffling, and powerful for about 45 minutes. After that lady came out to my house, she told me she was going to take me to a meeting. And she said one of the most remarkable things that you could say to anyone. I told her, I said, I got to do something on account of these kids. And I told her about that look I had seen in my children's eyes and how badly it hurt me. She said, you're not going to stay sober for your children. You're going to stay sober for yourself. That's the greatest thing anybody ever told me. Do it for yourself. And I'm telling you that. Do it for yourself, you know. Okay. About 45 minutes before going to that first meeting, two lush-haired buddies of mine came by there, and they gave me two drinks of something. And it was the same as pouring coal oil on dying embers. I got drunk. You know, I was high on a kite, and the woman come back. But we went to that meeting that night. And, you know, I read out of the big book, and that's the only thing I can remember of that meeting. Last morning when I woke up, these words came to my mind. Rarely have we ever seen a person fail. That's all I think about. Rarely have we ever seen a person. I said, well, I'm going back to another meeting because I'm going to find out what they're drinking that rarely ever fails. And I'm going back and I'm going to find it out. And I went back and I found out that they weren't, you know. I cannot say that I fell madly in love with my sponsors the way that I see some people love their sponsors. I didn't love mine like that. Oh, she had buck teeth and I was scared of her. And she kept pulling out this who me. This answer, yes, this thing, dear, and you're in. I thought, so Biddy must be getting 50 cents a yes. In drinking, driving, your reputation, if you've been in the fog over 20 years, how do you know it's cloudy in that? Do you think a low environment while drinking? Heavens, no, I merely created a low environment while drinking. And this, yes, a very dumb question. Do you prefer to drink alone? If I'm buying it, yes. If you're buying it, no. Some people. But you see, but she stuck with me. You know, she really did. She stuck with me. See, when I came into fellowship, you know, they ever called you, Matthew, would you like to go to a meeting this morning or this evening? No, I'll be by for you. That's all, I'll be by for you, you know, if you don't want to be haunted. Yeah, you know, after you've got into this house, then you're fairly new. Have you ever once stopped and thought, now what in the hell did I do this for? Well, not in bad enough condition without calling somebody up and telling them about it, you know. And I thought about my sponsor like a lot of men feel about their wives at times. I wish you'd go away, but don't go so far, I can't find you if I need you. You know, that's the way I talk about her, you know. So. And she not only did she sponsor me, she enlisted some more that was about as bad as her, you know, one of those kind of things. And I suppose today, I guess maybe I might sponsor somewhat the same way. I don't know. But, well, beautiful girl down there just gave me a pen that says, tough love, see, so I got a right to go home and raise hell. You know? But as time went on, I began to learn one thing this woman was constantly talking about, was discipline, discipline. One must discipline themselves. Well, I wasn't the type of person that believed in too much of discipline to begin with. I didn't have too much of discipline in my home with my kids. You know, after all, if you wake up with a hangover and you know, and your kids is making a lot of noise, you don't be hitting anybody. You give them a quarter and send them to the show and say, look, I'll get you next time, you know. And, you know, hit somebody and you got a hangover, you don't do that. And then on top of that, I always was too full of remorse to be beating on people. Because, you know, you go around feeling bad about yourself. My children loved me anyway. They thought I was a wonderful mother. I don't know how they feel now, but they thought that then. And they woke up in the morning, they wanted popsicles for breakfast. They got popsicles. But, you know, you don't have to cook no popsicle, you know. But I have learned, my friends, that discipline. And I wonder where the word discipline came from so much. Yeah. And I learned, my friends, that to be disciplined, one becomes a disciple. You know? This program, to me, is discipleship. See, friends, there's one thing that you and I need to constantly bear in mind after we have accepted this. That we are a disciple. A disciple is the one that has a message because he has disciplined himself to the extent of listening, you know? And then he gets it. As the big book tells you, obviously you cannot transmit that which you do not have, and that's the truth. Now, we're not going to become disciplined overnight now. You see, I still get a little rebellious every once in a while, you know. Every once in a while, you know, Holly Martin is still there, as far as that's concerned. But then I learned also, my friends, that there had been a pattern laid down for you and I to follow. You see, when the world was new from the hands of Almighty God, he had given us 10 commandments, 10 doses of medicine because the world was sick. 10 doses. But then people like me came along, as the big book says, some are sicker than others, and we had to have 12 doses of 12 steps. 2 more. Before you and I could accept discipleship. And then, you know, I look at these 12 disciples that our divine Lord had picked out to follow him. And in each one of them, I noticed the different personalities of each one and how discipline and discipleship formed each one of them. How they changed. And how you and I change when we become disciples of these 12 steps and of the big book. No. See, that first step that we had where we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives become unmanageable reminds me of one of our divine Lord's followers, Peter. Because that first step, like Peter, it brings me the message of humility. And brother, that's a tough one to come by. How I can identify with this disciple by the name of Peter? He was impulsive, impetuous, loud, boisterous, but he was born leader, but his life was unmanageable. And in spite of all of these things, he was still full of fear and cowardice. You know, if you can remember, he was a disciple that told when our divine Lord said, "You will deny me," and he's all, no, Lord, not me. But you see, the time of testing had not come. How many times have you and I said, "Oh, I'll never take another drink"? That's before we found the fellowship. Never again. But like Peter, the time of testing hadn't come. What happened to Peter? Why? What happened to him was just exactly this. He was afraid of rejection. He was a coward. And the same thing sometimes happens to us. He was afraid of ridicule. He was afraid of not being accepted. He was afraid of persecution. You know. And sometimes even you and I know me, I did. I couldn't accept these things. Persecution. Being, you know, the stupidity of the whole thing. I'm letting alcohol persecute me all the time. But, you know, we want to remain so anonymous. But how anonymous are you when you're drunk, you know? Everybody in town knows about it, you know? You have to wake somebody up and tell them you're drunk, you know? See, that's many of the times before I came here, I said, never again. You remember that morning I told you about? Never again will I take a drink. But the time of testing had not come, you know? And finally, Peter's last denial, he stood there, as the book of books tells me, warming his hands by the fire beside of the centurion. Warming his hands. He's getting too close. You know, many times when I see these places, you know, and say, "Oh, come on, you can come to here, you can go there." Uh-uh. I don't want to stand there warming my hands by the fire of the centurion, you know. "Oh, I'm just going to take this home. I'm not going to drink it. I'm just going to take it home in case somebody comes over. Baby, you warming your hands by the fire with the centurion, you know. So, I'm just going to buy this and keep it for Christmas. You done took the centurion home. You warming your hands." That kind of testing. And you see, like Peter, and the book of books tells us, that Peter, after this, when he found out, he was so full of remorse, he wept bitterly. Well, you and I did the same thing. After saying what we would not do, we did it anyhow. Anyway, because we were cowards. We were people pleasers. We didn't want to be ridiculed, you know. What do people say if I don't take a drink? If I don't drink with them? This will destroy. And they look at me. And they say, well, look here, you don't drink anymore. No, I can't have you destroying my image. You just screwed your image up yourself when you took the drink, you know? And you don't want to destroy your image. I want to be an all-around person. That's what Peter thought he was. And the humility that came to Peter when he found out at the time of testing, he wasn't brave at all. The same thing that happened to me. I wasn't brave at all when the time of testing came. I couldn't stand the test. Okay. And it brought me the message of teachability, which is humility. As we go on to our second step, we see another disciple. Oh, you're going to love him. He brings you the message of belief by experience. His name was Thomas. The second step, which tells me we came to believe in a power greater than ourselves that could restore us to sanity. You know, Thomas, he was one of these people, well, he brings me the message of belief by experience. You know, many times one says, well, I'll tell you my opinion. Nobody gives a rap about your opinion or what your experience. You know, there's just as many different opinions in this world as there is people. What we want is your experience. And here was Thomas. He was the doubter. Sometimes you and I would put on the air of disbelief because we feel that it is. Yes? You ask him. He can talk louder than me. Come on, son.
Muriel Norris. There's a Kathy D that is very sick in the lobby. Muriel Morris. Thank you.
Thank you. That's quite all right. So here we have this doubter. And many of us today are just like Thomas Doubter. This belief. You see, Thomas, he said, I just simply cannot believe that our divine... He just don't want to adhere to the second step because when one comes to believe in a power greater than himself, he or she is afraid that they might change because there is change is very necessary. Many people might say, well, you know, after all, I do not need God as I understand him, as you're telling me or understood him, whichever. Because I am a self-made man. That's why you're so screwed up. You're self-made, you know. I'll screw you up in a minute. So, you know. And then again, you know, I have my doubts. I ask him. I cannot believe. I ask him, and he's not helping me. Did you really ask him? See, action is the magic word. Helping him. He said, why? Did you really and truly ask? You see, if you want to get a taxi, You just don't go out there. You go out there in the street and you raise your hand. You know, you're like this. And when the taxi comes by, it don't just take your hand for a ride. It takes your whole being. So when one comes to believe in a power greater than himself, not part of you goes, but all of you go. You know? If you want an elevator, you don't just stand there and look at the thing, do you? You push the button. You know? You get off. So one has to raise his voice and ask. Thomas said, I can believe if I can just put my hand or my finger into the nail print and into his side. And our divine Lord said, Thomas, reach hither thy finger. You know, my friends, this is all that you and I have to do. The Lord of Luminous, you know, it takes action. There was a woman that had been ill for 18 long years with an issue. And she had tried everything under the sun. The book of books says so. If you don't believe it, read it. She had gone to doctors, to soothsayers, or whatever you go to in those days. All to no avail. She was still sick. And finally, that day came. After having spent all. You ever get that feeling? Lord, I've done everything. After having spent all, she saw him in the crowd. And she said, if I can just but touch the hem of his garment. You see, my friend, when one can admit, accept, and surrender, You had touched the hem of his garment. He felt you, like he felt her. So why is it? We will stand up and read the book God could and would if he was sought. And then turn right around and say, I ain't helping me. Why? Yeah. See, poor Thomas only wanted to know that he knew. And that's the way a lot of you feel. That's the way a lot of us all feel. We only wanted to know that you really knew. You knew it, but you wanted to know that you knew it. You know, we ask a whole lot of goofy questions, you know, because we really and truly want to know that we knew it. See? And all I had to do was... See, I always believed that there was a God. But I didn't trust him because I thought maybe he didn't know the full particulars. If he knew how these people treated me, you know, maybe he just didn't understand about these things, you know. But I had to come to believe, and when one comes to believe, he comes to trust in a power greater than himself. And the third step, which reminds me so much of Matthew, whose name was Levi, he brings me the message of decision. See, Matthew was a tax collector. I guess you'd compare him with something about like the IRS, and nobody likes those people. You know, you don't even don't like them today. Matthew was disturbed very much by his present life. He didn't like the way that he lived. And he had to associate. See, I can identify with Matthew because I didn't like the way that I lived, but I had to associate with people that did the things that I did because other people didn't accept the things that I did. And so Matthew had to accept other tax collectors like himself. He didn't like it. He didn't like it at all. And you were associated with people that you just couldn't stand, but they had the brown bag, so you put up with them, you know. And you go to the bar, you didn't like them. You didn't like her. But here was this person, the only type that's going to accept you. So naturally, I got to go along with you, but I didn't like you. I hated even not being around you. And you couldn't get in my house unless I saw you had a bag, you know. One bag to another, you know. Doesn't come to my house. Matthew warned it out, but he didn't know what to do. Hence, in the third step where we are given the privilege of making the decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God, you and I have a decision. Yeah. Something that alcohol never gave you in your life was the privilege of decision. When alcohol knocks you down on your knees, it says you better stay there. Yeah. Try to get up. You ever get up on one knee and the other falls off Monday? Don't help you. The bed's going around and you say, I'll catch it next time. So now you and I have the privilege of decision. So one day, as Matthew sat in his little booth collecting taxes, hating himself. Oh boy, didn't we hate ourselves. And how we lied and said you didn't, but you did. You hated yourself. I hated the things that I did, but I was powerful. And our divine Lord came by and he saw Matthew sitting there. And he said, come on, Matthew. His name was Levi. Then he said, come on, Levi. And the book of books tells me that Levi straightway, like he didn't say, now, Lord, you're going down the road there and I'll leave your telephone number. I'll pick up on you later. You know, he said that. He was so glad to get out of this mess that he was in. And he said, straightway. Third step, made a decision to turn my will and my life over to care of God. I'm so glad that I don't have to worry with it. You know? You know, or worry about it. Gratefulness. That's what that step gave me. You know, sometimes we think, big deal. You know, yes, I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to care of God. Ask yourself, who else wants it? You know, see. Who else wants it? My friends, it is indeed a privilege to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. And you see, now don't forget, sometimes, you know, we read too fast. Made a decision to turn my will and my life over to God. It doesn't say that. It says made a decision to turn my will and life over to the care of God. You still got a decision. You can take it back anytime you want to. Anytime. Not over to God. Over to the care of. Take it back. You know, alcohol won't let you take your will back. Mm-mm. No, no. When you take that, I'm not talking about you and I, say you and me, Ollie. See, that's first step starts out with we, but you turn that W upside down and it becomes me, you know? Okay. So here's what happens. How many times have I said, I'm just going to take a couple of drinks and that's going to be it? And the alcohol says, huh? Guess what you think? Oh, no, you're not. Because I've made the decision. I let alcohol make the decision for me. You know? And I can't take it back. You know? It's like making love to a gorilla. You don't stop when he says so. Leo, your grandmother's not a nice lady. Let's see here now, you and I, you know, have this privilege. I said them the same bad words this morning because it's Sunday. Not unless it's necessary. You know, but as we travel on, we look at the fourth step. We meet another disciple. His name is Philip. He was called the common sense disciple. And that's all inventory is, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. It's plain common sense. Many times people feel, we may feel, well, I'm in the fellowship now, I don't need an inventory. I'm sober, I don't need to take inventory. You know, you can't throw a silk blanket over me and make a racehorse out of it now. Don't work like that. An inventory, my friends, is absolutely necessary. I just don't feel that I need this inventory deal. I really don't, because I've got it all straightened out in my mind, and I'm just not going to take an inventory. Why not? See, Philip lived in this little small town of Bethesda, which was a seaside town. And the sailors came there, and they would carouse and all that sort of thing, and Philip didn't like it there. And he felt, I'm going to run away. Like many times you and I feel, like, I'm going to run away. But you see, when Philip met our divine Lord, Philip knew, I can't change the town, but I can change me. And that's what happens when you and I are given the privilege, and all of it is a privilege, of taking an inventory. You see, sometimes another thing when we are frightened of inventory, like I was, we feel that there's nothing good in it at all. It's all bad. That's not true. You see, Philip said to his friend Nathaniel, he says, you know, I think I've met the one. He was talking about the master. He said, I think I've met the one. And Nathaniel says, oh, no, I don't think so. Nothing good can come out of that little town. And Philip says, come see. And that's what you and I have to do in inventory. Take it. There's something there that possibly you can salvage. But first you got to come see. Like Philip told Nathaniel, come see. Let's see. Because an inventory takes care of this that is good, that which needs to be repaired, and some of the things I need to get along with. But you see, running won't do it. And so still we go on saying that inventory is not necessary. It is necessary. How will I know unless I come see? Well, I already know. No? Come see. There's a whole lot of things that you and I have that we didn't know we had. That all we have to do is try to improve upon. Because of the difference, you know, there's another step right behind that. If I'm not going to take an inventory, there's not much I can do with the fifth step than this. But it's a tough one. Not the fifth. Admitted to God, ourselves, and another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. That's a tough titty, but you need the milk. So we call this step Judas. Because it will betray you every time. Judas. just like Jesus betrayed our divine Lord. He brings me a message of self-forgiveness. You see, so great was Judas's crime that he couldn't forgive himself. And he went out and he hung himself. How many of us today, because we cannot forgive ourselves, go out and hang ourselves by the rope of self-condemnation? Oh, I can't forgive myself. You know, on your knees every night and ask God to forgive you, and then you get up and say, but I can't forgive me. So since when did you become a power so great that you can't forgive yourself? You know, but you ask God to, you know. See, here was Judas there, you know. He already had his plan in mind what he was going to do. And the book of books says, and then Satan entered into Judas. Mm-hmm. This is what causes these fifth steps there, you know. You already had your mind made up you wasn't going to do right. And you took that drink, and Satan entered in. Then you couldn't forgive yourself. And again, like Peter, you get full remorse, and you weep bitterly. But the fifth step helped me to alleviate all of this. Admit it to God, ourselves. And another, I love these two words, another human being. Isn't that wonderful? To admit to another human being. We could have used just one word, admitted to God and ourselves, and another person, but it says another human being. What do you mean? What do you mean? Compassion. You don't want to talk to somebody that says, you did. What we want is compassion and understanding. You did, so did I. So this is what happened. See, the fifth step, there's no organization. Motive. That's what it is, the exact nature. Motive. Why? Well, I can rationalize that. Oh, no, there's no rationalization when it comes to that fifth step. Rationalization is like masturbation. You're just screwing yourself. Now, that was the gospel according to St. Holly now, don't you? So now we move on to this sixth step. Entirely ready to have God. Remember now, entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. And you know, you and I will jump up and say, I can't do such and such a thing. Of course, if I ask you to, can I see your name in the big book? It isn't in there. It says entirely ready to have God remove. See, it brings to mind the disciple by the name of Simon the Zealot. You see, Simon was one of those what you might call, in those the what we would call today a guerrilla warfare fighter. He was just so full of hate and all of that sort of thing, but he caused a lot of pain to people, like you and I do today. But you know, we cannot do anything about the pain that we cause other people until we stop causing ourselves pain. How are you going to erase pain from someone else's heart and mind when you haven't done anything about your own? Entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Why? These things are painful. They're painful. No one wants to live with anything that is painful. If you would have got a tooth and it's hurting, then you go to the dentist and the dentist says, well, I think I'm going to have to pull that tooth out. And you go, oh, no, it's my tooth. Don't you dare touch it. Well, what did you go for? You didn't want to do something about it. You certainly are not happy with it. Is one happy living with jealousy? That is painful, is it not? So we become entirely ready to have Almighty God remove it, you know. Self-pity is painful. Do you all live with that? So we're entirely ready to have God remove it because they hurt, you know? In other words, they're malignant. And anxiety, oh God, that's contagious. It'll rub off on someone. So I have to become like St. Francis when he says, Lord, make me. Francis didn't want to do this. He said, Lord, make me an instrument of thy peace. He didn't say, Lord, can I become an instrument of your peace? He said, Lord, make me. You know, it is so wonderful to be an heir to the love of God. You know, you and I are all royalty. We haven't got any business walking around with our shoulders stooped over. We're royalty. And we should accept this. So in other words, my friends, when I look at that sixth step, I know there's not too much I can do about it, but to become willing, entirely willing, to have Almighty God remove these, because they hurt me. And I can't do anything about the pain that I have caused others until I do something about the pain that is eating within me. And then the seventh step, which is so short, very insignificant, so it looks, it reminds me so much of a little bit. Oh, they tell me he was a very small stature. Nathaniel, Bartholomew. You know, humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. We think, oh my gracious, that's such a small step. Well, we don't pay any attention to that step. It's too small. Well, you know what the Book of Books says? Beware the little foxes that gnaw at our vineyards because our vines have tender grapes. It didn't say anything about great big ones. It said, beware of the little foxes. It said about elephants and tigers. It says, little foxes. Those little bitty things. See, and they came to Bartholomew, you know, he was one of those little small people. He was small of stature. Yeah. But he made it to worlds and worlds. And that's what these little small things can do. You think they're small, but they'll make you know that they're there. Yeah. Now, if you walk down the street and you see an elephant coming down the street, oh, there's an elephant. I guess I better move over here. But all right, a gnat, a little N-A-T gnat can get in your house. It'll cause more hell than one legged man at a dance. Okay. He'll go buzzing, you know? And he gets up on the ceiling, you say, I'm going to get him. And you jump up on the couch and hide your shoes and your heel goes through the fabric and you hit him and he does one of them things at you, you know? And, okay. And he comes back down, he lights on the lampshade, you haul up and hit the lampshade and break the lamp. Little bitty things. They'll make you know that they're there. Humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. Now, we have two other disciples, James and John, sons of thunder. Because they were, shall we say, full of love. John is known as a disciple of love. And my friends, it takes love. It takes love to make amends. I don't like making amends. But it has to be. It has to be. You know, why? Because I want peace with myself. And you know, many times in making amends, we start out, we do the Adam. You know, the first man that was ever created, Adam. You know. Here was Adam, you know, in the garden. We start out doing the Adam when it comes by brain placement. You don't make any amends. Start right away saying, well, you know, so-and-so hadn't done such and such thing. I wouldn't have did such and such thing. So that's the reason why I should make any amends. That's what's called the Adam deal. So after Adam, one of the beautiful things about it, when God got ready to get down on Adam's case, the Book of Book will tell you that it came walking in the cool of the day. See, that is one of the most beautiful things. See, you and I sometimes, when we're going to make amends or straighten a thing out, we start, shall we say, in the heat of the argument, or the heat of the day, or the heat of the situation. But the Book of Books tells me that God came walking in the cool of the day, after everything had quieted down a bit. Yeah, that's a good way to start it. Yeah. And he asked Adam a question. He says, Adam, where are you? Well, God knew where Adam was. But God wanted Adam to know where he was. See, Adam didn't know where he was. See, Adam knew he had tore it. He knew he had tore it. So he says, you know, I'm here. Lord, yeah, I heard you call me, but I hid. You know, Adam knew he had towards some kind of way there. The first thing he did was start brain placing. God said, you know what you did, don't you? He said, well, yeah, but, you know, she did it. You know, I really think that's why men have Adam's apples today. He bit off of something that got caught there and he wasn't able to swallow it, you know. So once when it comes down to making amends, I've got to become willing to make amends. And I've got to try to do it through love before I do the Adam and go and hide to keep from making amends. Yeah. Have you ever seen anybody that you knew you should make amends when you're in the hide? You go and hide to keep them talking to them. That's called the Adam. And then when you do have to do something about it, you say, but you know, so-and-so did that first. But that step doesn't say that. It says made direct amends. That's a tough one, but it's there. Many times we don't want to make amends because we're afraid people might find out that we're human. And it has to be human, doesn't it, dear? When one is human, he loves, and he doesn't mind being loved in return. He doesn't have to go and hide. No. So as we look again at a disciple that brings us a message, steadfastness. You see, the tenth step where we continue to take an inventory, and when we're wrong, promptly admit it. Continue. There was a disciple by the name of Jude. Thaddeus. His name was Judas. But his name was changed to Jude Thaddeus. For the simple reason is, he didn't like that name anymore. You know, begging to you. Little stigma on it. Just like many of us, you know, but he brings us the message of steadfastness. What do we mean? How can I identify with this man? You know, every time you meet somebody, you know, that of us that know, no explanation is necessary. Those that don't know, it's impossible, so you don't go through all that rigmarole with them, you know? So here when we meet our boy Judas, Jude as he was later called, he had to be steadfast to continue on regardless of what the name was. How many times you and I don't want to be called an alcoholic? Because someone has said, well, you know, oh, you belong to that thing? Well, you know, honey, I knew an alcoholic and he did such and such a thing. Remain steadfast. He did that. You didn't do it. You didn't have anything to do with it. Well, you know, I wouldn't let him in. You know, he's going to ruin the program. He may ruin his program, but he ain't going to ruin mine. See? Because I remain steadfast. Continue to take a personal inventory, and when I'm wrong, promptly admit it, regardless of what anyone else says. You know, sometimes a person might say, well, look, you go to that program, you know, I am, this makes me, shall we say, I don't like to play second fiddle. Tell them to get out the band then if you don't want to play second fiddle. You know, there's always a trumpeter waiting to take your place, you know. So here, it has to be this way, that I continue regardless because of this message, steadfastness. So when we come to the 11th step, we will deviate slightly, where we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact point only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. The reason why I say we will deviate slightly, because we're going to talk about Luke, you know. Luke was a physician. Luke did not, he was born later, he did not walk with our divine Lord, but he wrote one of the most beautiful books that you'll ever read. And how I can identify with Luke was this. Luke being a physician and had not walked with our divine Lord, he had to go right to the source. He had to go and find out where all of these things happened before he could write his book. Accuracy is what he needed, you know. And that's what you and I do in the 11th step. We seek through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact. Like Luke, he went to the source. And that's where the seat is, at the source of it, the 11th step. Sought through prayer and meditation, not medication, meditation. That's what it says, you know. Because I will remember always that I am in the recovery room as long as I am in this fellowship. I will be in the recovery room. Always. You know? Because I have had one of the greatest of all operations, given by the greatest of all physicians, known as a personality operation. When one has had an operation of any type, he's put in the recovery room where there is supposed to be a very efficient nurse constantly taking his or her four vital signs, your pulse, respiration, and what have you. You see, I know my four vital signs. Pride, fear, resentment, and self-pity. There are four vital signs of the average alcoholic. Pride, fear, resentment, and self-pity. And all I've got to do, I don't need anyone else to take them. I can call on the physician myself. Lord, something is out of whack here. One of my vital signs is going to miss, and I have to watch that. But like Luke, I have to go to the source, and that is exactly where it is. You know, my friends, this beautiful 12th step that we have reminds me so much of a disciple by the name of Andrew, having had a spiritual experience as a result of these steps. He said, nothing ever happened to me. Did you read this step? It says, having had a spiritual experience as a result. That's a one word, the result of these steps. We tried. It didn't say he was always great. It says, we tried to carry the message. We tried. Yeah. Why do we try? We're like Andrew. You see, Andrew never wrote a book. You don't read no book in the Bible called the Book of Andrew. He didn't write it. But Andrew brought Peter, the greatest of all, to our divine Lord. But you know who Andrew brought first? Andrew brought Andrew first. Because obviously you cannot transmit that which you do not have. That's what the book says, though. But Andrew brought Andrew. Says we tried. Why do we try? Because our divine Lord says, when you are converted, strengthen your brother. Now, don't get all tore up about the word converted. It simply means changed. When you are changed, strengthen your brother. That's a privilege. And another disciple says, but Lord, how far shall a man go with his fellow man? And our divine Lord said, to the edge of the pit. But he didn't say nothing about falling off down in there with him, though. He says, to the edge of the pit. Because we know that we are not going to be able to help everybody. We know that. But how much of a PhD do you have to have to carry the message? How much of an MSW do you have to have to tell somebody that you love them? Do you have to go to school to tell somebody that you love them? You know? I'm not against all these things, but no stretch of the imagination, see. But you don't have to study love, you live it. That's all you have to do. The important thing, my friends, is from this person that I cannot help. Because my ego tells me I'm so great I can help everybody. You know, there's a story about an eagle. And for this eagle, he felt so great that day, he was stretched his wings and he was flying around and he saw a seal that had just crawled up out of the water laying on the edge there where the seals lay in the slime. And this eagle thought, I'm going to pull him out of there. I don't want him laying there. The seal don't want out of there. But the eagle feels, I'm going to get you out. So the eagle sticks his claws down in the seal. And he tugs one way. And the seal tugs another way. And the more the eagle tries to pull, the flesh of the seal begins to, shall we say, stick closely to the talons of the seal. And the tug of war begins. The seal pulling one way, the eagle pulling another way. Sounds like Al Man, doesn't it? Now, I mean, but I love my Al-Anons. I love them fine. You know, they're nothing but alcoholics turn wrong side outwards anyway. You know? But you see, what happened with the seal and the eagle, the eagle couldn't turn loose. And the seal drug him right on out there in the ocean and drowned him. Because he couldn't let go and let God, so he drowned him. That's why the divine Lord says to the edge of the pit. That's exactly why. You know? Because you see, my friends, as time goes on, and you and I know that we strengthen our fellow man. Because we gain in discipleship. What price? Discipleship. What is the price of discipleship? I'll tell you. It's very simple. You see, and this, let's take this convention here. We see people walking around with badges on so that we will know who they are. Chairman, leader, hostess, worship. They're part of it all. So they wear a badge. So how will one know that one has become, you know, that person has become a part of the convention? But how will one know when he has the badge of discipleship? But what our divine Lord told us, one simple thing, just one. And you and I, when we get that, we have it. He said, a new commandment that I give you, that you love one another. And by this shall all men know you are my disciples. God bless you.